This week, occultism and science. What common ground do they have? Is there a sort of mental Venn diagram that we could explain the science of occultism? In a piece penned in 1913, we explore this idea and perhaps come away with a better understanding of the practice of the occultist. Then, we'll follow it up with a short piece exploring some of the connections between jazz and Freemasonry. Many jazz musicians have been Masons, but is there a connection that goes deeper than just fraternal bonds? All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 631. I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the program. Without you, we can't do the show like we do it, which is making constant improvements every chance we get, and ensuring that all episodes are available all the time with no exclusive backlog. First and foremost, our producer pin update. We are currently awaiting our quote, and we will get those out just as soon as possible. Now, if you're out there and we owe you a pin and you would rather reorder at another time, or you would like a refund currently, just let me know. No big deal. I can do that for you as soon as possible. Wanted to quickly mention that April 2nd, I'll be at Middleton Ionic 180 in Middleton, Wisconsin, doing the Esoterics 101 presentation. We'll cover a lot of information related to Freemasonry as a quote-unquote mystery school. We'll also explore other systems that have a tie into what we also practice. It'll be a lot of fun. You heard me mention time and time again a few events that are happening, that are coming up very soon. Number one is Kansas Masonicon. I'm going to attempt to coerce Brother Alex Powers to come on the program and talk a little bit about this. And other things that you can look forward to as well are interviews that will be coming shortly on the 2024 annual conference, the Midwest Conference on Masonic Education. Very much looking forward to this. If you're interested, please consider it. It will be May 3rd through the 5th in Minnesota's Masonic Heritage Center in Bloomington, Minnesota. This conference is going to be designed to present tools and techniques to educate Masons successfully, and all Masons in good standing from any jurisdiction are welcome. We educate the educators, and for more information, head on over to MCME1949, that's MCME1949.org, and I will be there as well as a ton of people from all over the place. Anybody who's anybody and is serious about Masonic education will be there. Other things to mention, we have the Space Novum retreat. This retreat filled up almost immediately, so we are now booked for the event. Those of you who got in early, thank you. So the retreat, again, filled up. We will be moving forward on that. And again, thanks to everyone out there who made that happen. The piece I want to read for you this week is actually written all the way back on April 3rd, 1913. Those of you who might be familiar with the late 19th and early 20th century spiritualism phenomena that accosted the world, very much so the United States, will no doubt be familiar with H.P. Blavatsky and her organization that spawned from her teachings, Theosophy. Now, along with H.P. Blavatsky, there are a handful of others that operated with her, people like Olcott and William Quan Judge, and just a slew of other people that followed or worked with her to develop the system. At a point, Blavatsky is ill, and she sort of turns it over, the organization Theosophy, that is, to her protege, who was Annie Besant. Now, Annie Besant is somebody who's very interesting because she's seen as a major humanitarian, in particular where the organization Theosophy, the world headquarters in Adyar, India, is stationed. Besant was considered a humanitarian there, having influenced the local people and cultures to sort of empower them at a time when the British were still very much influential over that area. And Annie Besant, along with other people who came before her, started a movement that allowed for men and women to be Masons. And so there are quite a number of organizations that exist today that have either mixed Masonry or are female-only Masonry, and considered by male-craft Masonry to be clandestine for this reason. Regardless of your opinion on that, what is fascinating to me is the birth of co-Masonry and people like Charles Leadbeater or Leadbeater, who are still raved about by occultists and Masons alike, even regular Masons, not knowing his questionable past both as a co-Mason, but none of that matters. What matters to me about Leadbeater is that he was a pedophile. Regardless of that, our topic today is Annie Besant, because she wrote an article on occultism back in 1913, and she's writing as a Mason. And so I wanted to read this to you. I think it's a good article, and I just wanted to give you guys some background on who Annie Besant is and why she's writing as a Mason, because the majority of Masons today are male-craft Masons who don't always have the background to know where some of these traditions of co-Masonry or mixed Masonry or female-only Masonry come from. And that should give at least some good context to what we're about to read on the topic of occultism. And this is, again, by, we'll give her her title, which is the very illustrious Brother Annie Besant, 33rd degree, in her organization. So let's check this out. I think you guys will be very interested. Freemasonry, as a continuation of the ancient mystery schools, is a tradition steeped in occultism and the study of hidden things, and requires the spiritual insight of the adept to perceive. H.P. Blavatsky defined occultism as the study of the divine mind in nature, and it would be difficult to find a nobler definition. All life, all energies, are hidden, and only their effects are patent. The forces by which a jewel is crystallized in the womb of the earth, by which a plant develops from a seed, by which an animal is evolved from a germ, by which a man feels and thinks, all these are occult, hidden from the eyes of men, to be studied by the scientists only in the phenomena of growth, of evolution, as these present themselves, while the impelling forces, the nature of vitality, the invisible, intangible, secret springs of all activities, these remain ever hidden. Moreover, this admirable definition posits mind behind all the manifestations which we totalize as nature. It is these manifestations which are woven into that garment by which we see God, and weave for God the garment thou seest him by. His mind is revealed in natural phenomena, and by the visible, the invisible things are clearly seen. Bruno spoke of natural objects as the divine language. They are the self-expressions of God. In the divine mind exist the ideas, which are to be embodied in a future universe. The world of mind, the intelligible world, precedes the material world. So taught the Hebrews, so taught the Greeks, and the teaching is confirmed by our everyday experience. We think before we embody our thought in an action. Ere a man creates a great picture, he must have the idea of the picture in his mind. He thinks it out before he paints it on canvas. It is the world of ideas, the intelligible world, which is the realm explored by the occultist. He seeks to understand this hidden world whence flow all outer manifestations, to grasp the ideas which embody themselves in varied forms, to seek the hidden sources of life, and to trace their outflow as the physical scientists seek and trace his physical types and their evolution. He is the scientist of the invisible, as the ordinary scientist is the scientist of the visible, and his methods are scientific. He observes, he experiments, he verities, he compares, and he is continually enlarging the boundaries of the known. The occultist and the mystic differ in their methods as well as in their object. The occultist seeks knowledge of God. The mystic seeks union with God. The occultist uses intellect, the mystic emotion. The occultist watches ideas embodying themselves in phenomena. The mystic unfolds the divine within him that it may expand into the divinity whose body is a universe. These sharp-cut definitions are, of course, true only of abstract types. The concrete individuals shade off into each other. And the preferred occultist finally includes the mystic. The perfected mystic finally includes the occultist. But on the way to perfection, the occultist must evolve pari passu in his consciousness and the successive vehicles in which that consciousness works, while the mystic sinks into the depths of his consciousness and cares not for the bodies, which he disregards and abandons. To borrow two well-known terms, the occultist tends to become the Jivanmukta, the liberated spirit residing in material bodies. The mystic tends to become the Jivanmukta, the liberated bodiless one. The occultist rise grade by grade through the hierarchy. The mystic becomes Nirmanakayas, the reservoir of spirituality, from which are drawn the streams which irrigate the worlds. Blessed, holy, and necessary are both types, the two hands of the one Logos in his helping of his universe. Bearing in mind H.P. Blavatsky's definition, we can readily see how the more ordinary view of occultism, that it merely means the study of the hidden without defining the hidden, inevitably grows up. The occultist is to study the divine mind in nature. Then he must not only expand his consciousness so as to enter into the divine mind, but must also evolve his subtle bodies and their senses in order to contact nature in all the grades of subtlety of her manifestations. This evolution of the subtle senses and the knowledge gained through them, of the phenomena of the subtle or the superphysical worlds of matter, loom large in the eyes of the superficial observer, and he comes to identify occultism with clairvoyance, clairaudience, traveling in the subtle bodies, and the like. It would be as sensible if this same good gentleman identified physical science with its apparatus, its microscopes, telescopes, spectroscopes. The subtle senses are merely the apparatus of the occultist. They are not occultism. They are the instruments by which he observes the objects which escape normal physical eye. As the ordinary instruments of science may have flaws in them and so may distort the physical objects observed, so may the superphysical instruments have flaws in them and distort the superphysical objects observed. Malobservation with a defective instrument does not vitiate the scientific method, though it may, for the moment, vitiate particular scientific conclusions. The same is true as regards malobservances with ill-evolved superphysical senses. The occult method is scientific and sound, but for the moment, the particular conclusions drawn by the occultist are erroneous. Where, then, is safety? In repeated observations by many observers, just as in the physical science. Let us examine this a little more closely. A scientific observer finds in his observations through his microscope yield him a certain picture. He draws what he sees. Then he puts a higher power on his microscope and again observes the object. He obtains another picture. He compares the two. He finds that certain parts of the object that he thought were isolated from each other are connected with threads so fine that they were invisible under the lower power. His first observations were accurate but incomplete. One result of such incompleteness is that every scientific man, in giving pictures of objects as seen through the microscope, notes on them the power of the lens through which he observed them. Again, if a younger observer, on comparing his drawings with those made by experts and inserted in the textbooks, finds that he has inserted something not seen in the others, he will test his lens and repeat his observation, taking another object identical with the first, lest some dust or hair or other accidental intruder should have presented itself, unbidden for his inspection. Let us apply this to the student of occultism. He has evolved a power of sight beyond the normal. He observes some etheric object and puts down his observations. A few years later, having evolved a higher power of sight, he observes the object again and finds that the two parts of it he thought successive are divided by some intermediate process. I will take an exact instance. Mr. Leadbeater and myself, in 1895, observed that the ultimate physical atom, being disintegrated, broke up into the coarsest form of astral matter. In 1908, observing the same process again with a higher power of sight evolved during the intervening years, we saw that the physical atom on a disintegration ran through a series of further disintegrations and reintegrated finally into the coarsest form of astral matter. The parallel with the lower and higher powers of the microscope is complete. Once more, a young observer sees some astral form. He compares it, if he is wise, he is not always wise, with previous observations of older observers or with statements by great seers in the world scriptures. He finds his observation unlike theirs. If he is a serious student, he tries again, making repeated and careful observations and finds out his mistake. If he is foolish, he proclaims his malobservation as a new discovery. But it may be said, people respect the physical scientist and accept his observations while they mock at those of the occultist. All the discoveries of new facts were mocked at before the public was ready for them. Was not Bruno burned and Galileo imprisoned for declaring that the earth moved around the sun? Was not Galvani called the frog's dancing master when he laid his finger on the hidden force now called by his name? What matters the mockery of ignorant men to those whose steadfast eyes are seeking to pierce through the veils in which nature shrouds her secrets? So far as the methods of observation of the material side of nature are concerned, observations carried on by means of improved apparatus, externally manufactured or internally evolved, the methods of physical and of the superphysical science are identical. Knowledge is gained by study of the results obtained by predecessors in the same field, and by observations directed to similar phenomena, with a view to viewing or correcting the results. The evolution of consciousness, which observes through the senses, is another matter, and this plays a greater part in occult than in physical science, for consciousness must unfold as higher senses evolve, else would the better tools be useless in the hands of the inefficient workman. But the object of physical and superphysical science alike is the extension of the boundaries of knowledge. Is this extension desirable or not? If the knowledge be turned to human service, yes. If to the increase of human misery, no. The application of physical science to the destruction of human life is most evil. Yet not for that can we seek to block the advance of chemistry. The occultist who knows how to liberate the forces imprisoned in the atom will not place within the hands of the competing nations of the world this means of wholesale destruction, yet he knows that chemistry is advancing in this direction, and that it must not be hindered in its advance. As regards to the occultists themselves, they are useful or dangerous according to their motives. If they are devoted to the welfare of the worlds, then their rapid evolution is beneficial. If they seek power for their own aggrandizement, then they are dangerous. The evolution of consciousness is all to the good, for as that unfolds, the wider view brings the man gradually more and more into unison with the divine will in evolution. And at a certain point in this expansion, he inevitably recognizes the all-encompassing claims of the larger self. But in the lower stages in the astral and mental worlds, while his self-discipline must be rigid as regards to his body's pride and selfishness may make him a danger to his fellow men. The discipline of the senses and the control of the mind are equally necessary, whether the man is aiming at development for service or for individual aggrandizement. He must lead a life of rigid temperance in all things, and he must become a master of his thoughts. But if personal ambition rule him, if he seeks to gain in order that he may hold, not in order that he may give, then every added power becomes a menace to the world, and he enters the ranks of the adversary. The occultist must evolve into a Christ, or into a Satan, to borrow the Christian terms. For him, there is no halfway house. Safer are the green pastures where the flock may feed at peace than the arid heights with their crevices and their precipices, with their shrouding mists and their crashing avalanches. None who has trodden part of the rugged way would seek to induce others to enter on it. But there are some who imperious inner force compels, some who cannot resist by the still waters but must seek to climb the heights. For such the way is open, and for them there is no other way which is possible, only that they may not add their shattered lives to the wrecks which strew the path of occultism. Let them gird their loins with strength, let them don the armor of purity and the helmet of unselfishness, and then let them go forward, in the name of the world's redeemers, with their eyes fixed on the star which shines above them, careless of the stones which gash their bleeding feet. Annie Besant, 1913. A very interesting article, not touching on Masonry except perchance. In the latter half of the article, she mentions the discipline necessary to separate the unselfish and the selfish. The Mason would tend to think that the lessons of Masonry are the tools by which you can prepare yourself to become this selfless individual. And then, through active processes and teachings and studying, to open yourself up into the realms in studying the occult phenomena, whether that be by visualizations or perhaps in the theosophical realm of things, you look at it like the astral, all of these kinds of ideas. But what I also loved about this is the argument of the scientific and the occultist view of the phenomena of the world. And just like Heisenberg once said that what we see isn't reality. What we see is merely what we recognize as reality through the tools that we invent to measure reality, if that makes any sense to you. And in this same way, Besant is calling the human its own tool of measurement, its own psychic tool of measurement that can be honed, can become better, can become perfected over time. And they're arguing for this same sort of thing. And certainly there is some merit here when we think about the various, I guess, elements of parapsychology that would exist, it being a relevant field in modern times. In fact, something that famous astronaut and Mason, Edgar Mitchell, studied extensively with an organization that he started. The next piece I have for you this week is by Brother Jonathan Dinsmore, who writes for universalfreemasonry.org. And I do enjoy his viewpoints on a lot of things. And in particular, he wrote this article called Jazz Musicians in Freemasonry. Now, it's a short piece published back in February of 2019. I don't know about you all, but my music tastes are pretty eclectic. But my favorite genre of music is best described as early era jazz. Not what you might think of when you turn on the radio and there's some sort of smooth jazz guitar playing. That's not really my thing at all. However, I love Count Basie, I love Duke Ellington, I like big bands like Glenn Miller. Not a huge fan of vocalists within the music, but I do make certain exceptions, particularly for Count Basie. I've always had a fascination with this. I think it's just because I grew up listening to this kind of thing with, you know, being played in the house, and so I have a pretty decent record collection of some of my favorites, but I do collect Count Basie albums. So, I wanted to read this, and selfishly, because I like this early American jazz. So let's check it out. Jazz Musicians and Freemasonry by Brother Jonathan Dinsmore, First Degree, published February 10th, 2019. There is a clear connection between music and Freemasonry, but why have so many famous jazz musicians been Freemasons? When we think of the connections between Freemasonry and music, where most people's minds probably go first is to Mozart, who is the most famous classical composer to be documented a Mason, although some speculate about Beethoven as well. Indeed, Mozart even wrote Masonic themes into his music, and, as was discussed, in many other writings. What many do not realize is that there are perhaps more famous jazz musicians who were Masons than classical composers, or perhaps any other genre. Why does Freemasonry count so many renowned jazz artists among its ranks? That's what we'll be learning about in this post, both the history and the reasons for Masonry's jazz connections. First, let's just take a look at some of the big names from jazz history who have been a part of the Brotherhood. Duke Ellington, Irving Berlin, Nat King Cole, Count Basie, Glenn Miller, and Dizzy Gillespie are just a few household names you might recognize who were either proven or almost certainly Freemasons. There are yet more to list, but these are probably the biggest names who even casual jazz fans will recognize. Sun Ra, an interesting character by any measure, is also theorized to have been a member of a Prince Hall Lodge, or a lodge of related fraternal order, throughout his career. While not the most well-documented Mason, his flamboyant Egyptian-inspired stage garb and cosmic philosophical expressions certainly make him at least the most colorful character to be associated with both jazz and the Masonic tradition. So why is there a connection between Freemasonry and jazz? One of the suggested reasons that Freemasonry has been so appealing to musicians throughout history is that, along with valuing music as one of the seven liberal arts, it also made it easier for those who lived on the road. By being a Freemason, traveling musicians could easily plug into any community and support network they encountered via the local lodge. It also provided support at times of sickness and death, which, to the sometimes empty-pocketed musicians, could be a godsend. Jazz history is also intimately intertwined with African-American history, and so it shouldn't surprise us that many of these jazz musicians were connected to Freemasonry through Prince Hall Lodges. At the time when jazz proliferated, and many of the African-American jazz Masons were in their heyday, much of the country was still segregated, and racial tensions were still high. Life as a musician already wasn't easy, and if you add to that being part of an actively persecuted ethnic group, it's not hard to see why the benefits of fraternal life would be appealing, even empowering, to the African-American jazz musicians in the early to mid-20th century. However, it also seems likely that there are deeper reasons for the connection than simple utility and networking. Jazz is known by most as a type of music, but it's also a subculture, and that subculture has its own sort of philosophy and ethic. If we reflect upon both ideas embodied in the music of jazz, as well as the culture surrounding it, we can find many correlations which give a deeper understanding to the connections between jazz and Freemasonry than simply being a useful fraternal organization for musicians. Both Freemasonry and jazz, for instance, are about generating new ideas, innovation, and forward thinking are qualities that are embraced both in the lodge and in the creation of jazz music. There's also an inclusiveness to jazz, having originated in the intermingling of various cultures and musical styles in New Orleans in the early 20th century. And that symbiosis and confluence of cultures toward a common goal of progress together is certainly a value held by Masonry as well. On a more abstract level, we can look at the actual musical nature and structure of jazz, some of which can be quite abstract, and draw another correlation. Anyone who has developed an appreciation for jazz, especially the more abstract variety, can understand how the phrase ordo ab caeo could be equally relevant to the craft of jazz as it was for the craft of Masonry. Just a quick little article, and I thought it was pretty cool, being a person who studied up on Count Basie and Duke Ellington and some of these guys. I know that several jazz musicians were Masons, but I never quite came across Count Basie's Masonic membership. I'm going to have to look into that one. I'll let you guys know what I find, unless you get to it first. That's it for this week. I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners. And if you're curious on how you can help support the WCY Podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out the various options. Thank you all so much for listening. We'll talk to you all next week. And until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
Yeah.